Historima. Listen to the extraordinary.
Ο κύριος σκοπός ήταν η πειθαρχημένη διαβίωση δήθεν των ανθρώπων αυτών εκεί.
The main purpose was disciplined living. I mean for the people there. They were citizens living a disciplined life under the supervision of the military and police authorities. And my title there was head of the medical service of the camp for citizens living a disciplined life under the supervision of the military and police authorities. It turned out to be the longest title I'd have in my career. I was born in Athens in 1940. For high school, I went to the experimental school of the university. I finished university and was given the rank of second lieutenant doctor in 1965 and began the life of a military doctor. There was a pre-dictatorship atmosphere in the army in 1965. The army was structured differently to the way it is today. Then it was still devoted to post-Civil War dogma. It still forbade and punished any different way of thinking. They tried to instill into the officer corps the idea of non-education, and secondly, to create division between those who wore the uniform and those who didn't. Of course, this led to some very rotten apples. At that time, the whole of Greece, the whole of society was on edge. Everyone was just waiting for something to happen, and then it happened. As I came down from my apartment that morning, 21st of April 1967, I found a soldier at the door. He was ugly-looking, badly dressed, with boots, loosely tied, and a gun. "Who the hell are you?" I shouted at him. At which point he said, "Lieutenant, sir." I was a second lieutenant doctor. "You need to go back inside. There's been a coup, and you need to go back home." I was stunned. At that moment, a captain who lived in the apartment building opposite came out. We were on speaking terms, so I waved at him. "What the hell is going on?" He shouted back, "There's been a coup. Get your stuff together and go straight to your unit, okay?" Okay. This was my first experience of the dictatorship. I managed to find a taxi and finally managed to get up Alexandra's Avenue, going through the roadblocks manned by jumpy and angry cadets. I reached the hospital where I was stationed, and things had got ridiculous. I saw the hospital soldiers lined up on the pavement outside Agios Savas Hospital, and they weren't exactly the most professional soldiers in the world, and we had a rather stupid sergeant major in those days. He'd ordered them outside on the pavement with their weapons in a state I can't even begin to describe. So I got them together and got them inside. Inside. All of you? I was quietly very concerned. What do we do now? We'd never been trained for circumstances like this, and there was no easy way we could adapt to them. The political prisoners, the first to be arrested by the police and the army, were already being rounded up at the police stations and then at the racetrack. The day after the next, together with my colleague, we went to the gendarmerie school, as we'd been ordered, to be part of the staff that would go to Yaros to prepare the camp for the prisoners. We heard Yaros, and I had to look for it on the map. Some said that it was a barren island, but there were no details. I mean, we had no proper information. We were going with a few nurses and some crates of supplies, and that was it. We left from Amfiali, the naval base, where the atmosphere was really heavy. The Navy had not yet completely joined the dictatorship. It was a strange situation. We travelled on a landing ship, and by dawn, we were on the beach at Yaros. Coming out onto the island was a very, very strange experience of unbelievable isolation. The island had been characterized as a fort. It was forbidden for anyone to approach by whatever means. In other words, there was no human presence on the island. There were wild rabbits everywhere, and as we disembarked, we saw octopuses still scuttling around on the beach. What was wonderful, and still is the Aegean in the spring. The hint of green and the discreet small flower that covers everywhere. The second thing we saw was a large building. The prison building, it was called. It had been abandoned for years, left to the elements, and was built incredibly badly, with a series of ancillary rooms. From the distance, I could make out that one of those buildings had a faded red cross on its front, and I said to the nursing staff, "People, I guess that's where we're going, and get a move on. It looks like the gendarmes have got their eyes on it, and they'll take it." The prisoners began to arrive in landing craft. They came and disembarked on the island. They were all in really bad shape. They had been kept at the racetrack for several days in awful conditions. They arrived, and I saw a line of people slowly and wearily climbing up to the level ground following the orders of the guards. I was struck by the fact that the orders were given very calmly, no violence at all. Everyone had been affected by the whole situation. It was a very quiet group that walked up. The whole thing was miserable. I mean, to see so much weariness, so much sadness, so much insecurity in everyone, it was too much to process. Once the first large group of prisoners had gathered, the commander of the camp made a short speech, which I found rather unique, because he said, "Look, we have nothing personal against you. We're just following orders. Do what you can to survive biologically, and we'll do the same to survive officially." I remember those words well, and I've written them down. We were all in the same boat there. We all had to deal with the same problems. There were many political prisoners who'd experienced exile in the past, and they managed to organize themselves in the terrible, miserable conditions the buildings were in. In total, there were 7,800. As for us in the infirmary, we faced a number of problems. There were those who'd been taken from their hospital beds, conditions. Some who had recently undergone surgery, some who were disabled, who could not possibly remain in those conditions. There was this group of people who obviously could not survive in the conditions there, no question. So we made lists with as much evidence as we could and immediately sent them to the administration. They sent a troop ship to collect them. They boarded, and I remember the captain of the ship, a really nice man, asking me in a scared voice, "How are we going to travel with these people? They'll die on the way." We reassured him as best we could. The man was really scared and incredibly concerned. Thankfully, the voyage went well. Anyway, we tried our best to provide good medical assistance. Whatever physical abuse had taken place had happened before transportation to the island at the racetrack or the police stations. There were issues. There were people who'd been beaten, those with serious problems from abuse, both men and women, who we took care of. All that time, we operated according to one process, one policy. None of us wanted to do anything unlawful. If someone came who'd been abused, we described any apparent signs of the abuse and whatever he told us on an admissions form, which was sent to the camp administration with a copy kept in the infirmary. This process was carefully followed the whole time we were on Yaros and then on Leros later on. For example, on Yaros, let me remember this correctly, there was this lovely dentist, Eleni, from Piraeus, who had serious bruises from the serious beating she'd been given. Another really intense moment was on Leros, in Partheni. The well-known naval union leader had been transported to us by the police from Piraeus, and he'd also undergone a severe beating. His condition was clearly serious. My staff and I admitted him. We recorded everything. And I got a call from the police in Piraeus, from some officer, I'm not going to name him. "Look, we're colleagues. This man, we need to help each other." I said to him, "Excuse me." He'd really irritated me. "Firstly, we're not colleagues. Secondly, what do you want me to do? 300 people have seen what was done and it's been reported and sent to the administration. How can I say it never happened?" "Ah, but tomorrow we're going to have the top brass here and I want to avoid embarrassment." "You should have thought of that earlier," I told him. "Speak to the commander." The camp commander was with me. He said, "Look, this is your fault. You want to beat a man up? I don't care. But you fix him up and then send him. You've sent him to us now to cover up for whom? What the hell?" Most of the abuse that happened, and I repeat, it was not at the camps. It was the result of the moral vacuum of some of the little people. Life went on at the camp. During those first months, we had unbelievable visits by helicopter from the dictator Patakos, which were just absurd. I confess, they were laughable. He was just incredible, wearing a brigadier's uniform, marching up and down, always making smart comments. The things he came out with are unrepeatable, unbelievable. I admit that I used to hide at the back because I'd burst out laughing. I know all this sounds incredible, but that's how it was. There were so many things with Patakos. Let me tell you a quick story. Once he came to tour the central prison building, and he went into the women's section on his own. I was somewhere nearby, and at some point, I heard a row. I went over. What had happened? He'd gone in and started shooting off his smart mouth. To whom? To 300 women, who all started to shout him down. Unbelievable. They drove him mad. He got out as fast as he could, and he never went back in. He went down to the infirmary, there inside the prison. He said one thing to one person, something else to another, whatever you can imagine. Inappropriate language and what he thought were clever comments. That's all he could manage. And then there was another row. I heard a powerful voice shout, "The night is dark in the mountains, Patakosh." So I went over. It was Lakis Papoulas. Papoulas had been a major in the cavalry and had been demobbed when the junta came in. He was in the party, the United Democratic Left. He was a tall, broad, strong man. Just the sight of Patakosh made him furious. He'd had him as an NCO before the war in a camp and had tried to teach him to disassemble, assemble, and maintain the new machine guns that Papoulas had brought over from France for the army. He explained and explained again, but he just couldn't get it. Patakosh was incapable of understanding. So Papoulas had said, "The night is dark in the mountains," meaning the man's head was empty. And then when he saw him again, "The night is dark in the mountains." Everyone just fell about. Unbelievable. He left in a hurry. I just couldn't stop laughing. I couldn't. I mean, he could see me laughing. He didn't say anything, of course, but I just couldn't stop. It was unbelievable. Now you'll say all I'm talking about is fun and that kind of thing. Well, that's life. Life there wasn't just the dramatic stuff, it was the fun as well. Of course, our life wasn't fun at all, but it was a large part of our reaction, the natural reaction of logical people to those times. A large part of society did not take them seriously.
Εν ονόματι της Επαναστάσεως, η οποία συνεχίζεται αναπτυσσομένη μέχρι ολοκληρώσεως και κατοχυρώσεως της αποστολής της, απευθύνομαι σήμερα προς το νουν, αλλά και προς την καρδία σου.
More evidence of this was that at some point they sent enlighteners to teach us and enlighten us about the principles of the revolution of the 21st of April. Where? In a prison camp on Yaros. They positioned megaphones around the camp and started to speak. And there was not one of us who didn't laugh. I've never heard such incoherent, unmitigated rubbish in my life. Everyone in the barracks had adopted a strange, old-fashioned way of speaking Greek called Katharevousa. In the army, in the old army at least, the officers tried to speak in what they thought was good and proper Greek using Katharevousa, which they royally butchered. Then there were the journalists, inside many quotation marks, who would come for interviews and report from the camp. These were people who were completely in the pay of the propaganda services of the state at the time. I've no idea who selected them. Each one of them was more stupid than the other. They'd come and ask the prisoners, "Do you go swimming?" "Oh, yes," they would reply. "Sure, and we've got great swimming trunks." I mean, ultimately, even in the middle of all this sadness and bitterness, people could see a ridiculous individual for what they were and made fun of them. It's just a fact. They reported that we went swimming every day and dined on lobster and fish, whatever rubbish came into their heads first. I stayed in Yaros until October 1967. I was then transferred directly to Leros, and there I had an adventure with the naval revolt. It was evening, and I was leaving the camp, which was right next to the naval fuel depot. At some point, as I was going to my car, I felt something behind me. I turned round and saw a huge destroyer with all its lights and engines off. It was moored there to get fuel. It was one of those that had mutinied. Suddenly, I was caught in a searchlight, and I was in my uniform. I heard an angry voice from above. "Get that hardliner! Get him!" and two or three sailors ran down. Ah, I said to myself, okay, and I got the hell out of there. I got into my car and drove the hell out of there. Of course, the next day, the administrator of the camps, a colonel, called all the officers together and told us there had been a coup by the king and we were the Royal Gendarmerie. So I said, fine, which side are we on? Whoever wins, he replied. Ah, I said, so it's like that. That's the way things were during the dictatorship. What I can tell you is that I decided to be as precise, correct, and careful as I could, because I'd just started my career and my adult life. There was no point in risking all that without, of course, abandoning my morals. That I was in the camp for a year was recognized in the years that followed, and I truly came to realize that most of us understood what was happening, and both officials and prisoners came to terms with it. It's a great thing when people who've been wronged give you their trust. And I remembered when I was young, I was a scout. We took an oath. We gave the scout's oath and we would say, I promise on my honor to obey, etc., etc. I was young then. We had a very good man as the leader of our troop on the Acropolis. And I asked him, can you tell me what on my honor means?
Μου λέει, κοίταξε, τιμή σου είναι να σε εμπιστεύονται οι άλλοι.
He replied, look, your honor is when other people can trust you.
Αυτό το κράτησα και το κρατάω ακόμα.
I held on to that and I still do.
Αυτή είναι η τιμή του ανθρώπου.
That's what a person's honor is.
Και εγώ το ένιωσα πολύ δυνατά φεύγοντας από τα στρατόπεδα.
And I felt it very intensely when I left the camp of exiles.
Historima. Listen to the Extraordinary. A collaboration between ERT Echo and Historima.org. Historima is supported by a founding grant from the Stavros Niarchos Foundation.